Our second speaker, Mr. Jeff Suka, Dr. Jeff Suka. He was my mentor at Appalachian State University. I'm very excited to see him here now. He's with New Hanover Regional Medical Center, and thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, everybody. You know, it's interesting. I've been teaching for a long time, and I've enjoyed it. I love teaching, but every time this kind of thing happens, I get a little nervous. My hands start sweating a little bit. Heart rate goes up, but I'm excited to be here. And Mike, I hope I don't step on your toes a little bit, but some of the things I'm going to say might be of a different opinion than yours, and I'm going to hopefully justify that. I'll give you some background on why I'm talking about the things that I am today. 6 months or so ago, Hannah and I had a phone conversation about some things that she heard with regard to the direction that things might be moving with regard to cardiac rehab. Having 25 years of experience in cardiac rehab, 30 years in clinical exercise physiology, I've seen things change throughout. What I'm concerned with, though, is that in the process, we're losing our own identity as exercise physiologists by losing the science within cardiac rehabilitation. And I'm going to try to point out why I think that we need to remember the science, the scientific principles, and the applications therein, so that when we practice with our patients, we're giving the very best of all treatments to all different varieties of patients. Now, the context of this is simple. You know that you're always going to have a group of people that are going to come into cardiac rehab. They're going to do so much. They're going to do a modest amount of exercise because they're probably not capable orthopedically or not willing or for some other reason not motivated. And it is good for them to move, and anything that they do when they do come in is a benefit. Then you're going to have a group of people, on the other hand, who are going to want more and need more. And I've kind of developed my philosophy around this idea. For most of the patients, a modest amount of exercise in that moderate continuous training mode, the idea that you can just keep them in that 11 to 13 or 3 to 6 RPE and they do their 30 to 45 minutes, and that's better than nothing, right? But then what do you do when you're faced with a 35-year-old, a 46-year-old, a 50-year-old who says, I want to go run a marathon, I want to go, that's not going to work for them. So we have to be able to flex up with our knowledge, our understanding, and our competence and our ability to provide safety through exercise when we monitor our patients. And I do believe in monitoring our patients throughout, and I'll tell you why in just a bit, but I think those are tools. I think those are tools that help me do my job better for those patients. So what I'm going to talk to you about is the challenge that we're faced with keeping the science and the exercise within cardiac rehab. I have no disclosures, and I'll tell you what my objectives are. I want to share with you my perspective on why I believe we need to keep science in the exercise physiology, as I mentioned. I'm going to hopefully do that from the background of a fundamental argument that comes from the research that is out there and the opportunities that that research presents to us. I'm going to review with you what our governing agencies tell us we should do with regard to exercise testing and exercise prescription. And then I'm going to talk about the 6-minute walk test and our fundamental default mechanism of exercise prescription, in that resting heart rate plus 20. Not to say that they're not good tools, but to help us realize their limitations. The idea that you have to know more than just the fact of what a 6-minute walk test is. You've got to know when it works and when it doesn't. So, things I've heard that concerned me, and I think I wasn't at the meeting last year, but at last year's annual NCCRA meeting, there was this idea that we don't need to monitor. Mike alluded to it earlier. Sorry about the spelling mistake. I just noticed that. Hannah should have fixed that when I sent that to you. So I like the idea, when it comes to little monitoring, that we give patients a feeling of freedom. I like the idea that we can foster independence by cutting them free from this gadget that seems to keep them safe and their perception. And I believe that to be true. I believe that if we didn't have to monitor patients, we could be more productive, right? Because there's one less thing that you have to do when you're chasing after your patients. Not only do you not have to put it on, but you don't have to look at the screen to know what's going on. And if you look at the screen, that means you have somebody who knows what they're looking at when they're looking at that screen. So we can control costs a little bit better, and we can make our patients more comfortable. And I give you all of those things. But here's what I don't like about letting go of the monitoring. I do believe we need to know what rate and rhythm are at all times. Maybe not for all patients all of the time, but when I get into this argument a little bit more, I'm going to tell you that for the type of exercise prescriptions that we do at my facility, we need to know what it is at all times. And if you're progressing and you want to assess responses, then I think you better pay attention to rate and rhythm. And if you get rid of the telemetry monitor, what tools are you going to use? Are you going to palpate, heart rate monitor, pulse oximeter? If you have a dysrhythmic patient, an AFib patient, we know that those tools don't work very well in those conditions. So if we don't have monitoring, are we more cautious in the prescription? My hunch is that we are. If you don't know what you're looking at, then you're probably less likely to move forward with maybe the vigor or the aggressiveness that might be necessary in some cases. And then finally, here's the one thing that I think is true. If I'm a patient and I come into your cardiac rehab program and you possess a certain amount of knowledge and skill and professionalism that comes with knowing how to read an EKG, putting on a monitor, telling me what that tool is for, why you're going to use it, then I think you're going to walk away from me feeling like, hey, I feel comfortable and confident in those folks' hands. If, on the other hand, I say, you don't really need that monitor, and if you just can walk on that treadmill and be comfortable and talk while you're walking, and they leave my facility thinking, well, I just walked without a monitor, and if I could talk and walk at the same time, it was good. And then I scratch my head and say, I can do that at home. Why do I need them to do that? And that's the challenge. The challenge really becomes our way of keeping them safe during exercise by using our tools and pushing them to whatever ability we think or level we think they should go. The talk test. So I think you had a speaker last year at your state meeting that talked about a surrogate test for assessing exercise intensity. The talk test, while you're walking on a treadmill, if you can recite the Pledge of Allegiance, two sentences or whatever it is, and you don't feel labored or you don't gasp for air, you should be exercising at the appropriate intensity. And I think that's true to a point. So let's talk about that for just a second. I'm a physiologist, clinical physiologist, so we're always going to talk about something physiologic when I'm going to talk to you. So what happens during that talk test? So there is a disruption in your ability to talk while you're exercising, and that usually occurs right around your ventilatory anaerobic threshold. So stopping here for just a second, Hannah and Addie, Julie, sorry, switched you around. These guys were in the lab with me for a couple of years as they were graduate students. A lot of what they did was train with me doing this type of testing. And the idea of ventilatory anaerobic threshold is a concept that they're very familiar with. For those of you that aren't, ventilatory anaerobic threshold is the point in which non-metabolic CO2 is produced when hydrogen ions are created in excess because of the conversion of pyruvate to acetyl-CoA is interrupted by the rate of glycolytic flux, if that makes any sense. Lactic acid's promoted, hydrogen ion liberates itself from lactic acid. The hydrogen ion is buffered by CO2 or by bicarbonate. It goes on to produce CO2 in water. CO2 stimulates the respiratory control center, kicks up the breathing mechanism. Now you have an influx in your ventilatory rate. Now you have competition for air between words and supplying the body with the oxygen that it needs. So then you cannot talk above that ventilatory anaerobic threshold, or your talking is disrupted. So then the question becomes, at what intensity does that occur? And it usually occurs right around 40 to 60% of your VO2 reserve. So, and that's a non-CHF population, I should add, who usually have a ventilatory anaerobic threshold that's quite a bit higher because of peripheral glycolytic flux issues. So is 40 to 60% enough? For some, it is. So here's a project that we did at Appalachian State. One of my grad students did this. We took our patients, and unfortunately, in the cardiac rehab setting, the idea of formal randomized controlled design studies are fairly difficult to do unless you have a large institution, a large patient base, and you can relegate treatments to one group or another. We took our patients, retrospectively, looked back at how they performed, and wanted to know if they trained at a certain intensity within a... Do you guys know what moderate continuous training is? The concept? So all, for the most part, all of us are doing moderate continuous training. Unless you're doing high intensity interval training, you're doing moderate continuous training. 20 to 40, 40 to 60 minutes at heart rate between 40 to 80%, you know, 3 days a week or whatever, multiple modalities, so on and so forth. So we took our program, we took our patients, we had 36 in the moderate group, we had 54 in the vigorous group. We wanted to take a look at how they performed. All of these patients performed maximal, symptom-limited cardiopulmonary exercise tests before they started. VO2, 12 leads, go until you can't go anymore if everything looks good. Which, by the way, in my opinion, we all should be doing that on as many of our patients as we possibly can. The data is wonderful. So their test durations were between 8 and 12 minutes. Look at these heart rates. The heart rates, 143, 136, and at post-exercise, 142, 143, 93 and 92% of their age-predicted maximum heart rates. We all think what when patients are beta-blocked? Can't use your training heart rate range as an exercise prescriptive method. Well, I've got some data here on 100 patients or 90 patients that suggest that they're getting close to 92 or 3% of their age-predicted maximum. It's a large number of people, and that's a high percentage. That was very surprising to me when I did this project. VO2s, 23 and 22 to start, 26 and 26.3 to finish. Both statistically significant. So if I had two groups, and I should say this, the moderate group trained at about 51% of their VO2 reserve. The high intensity group trained at about 71% or 72% of their VO2 reserve. Both groups statistically improved. That's good, right? Mike alluded to a 3.5 milliliter per kilogram per minute increase in VO2 pre to post will decrease risk by 25%, 15-25%. This group increased by 2.5 mils. This group increased by 3.5 mils. So the more vigorous they exercised, the more likely they were to hit that 3.5 or 1 met threshold to decrease cardiovascular mortality morbidity risk. So clinically, they're not statistically significantly different, or I should say this, they're not statistically different, but clinically, 1 met versus non-1 met has a clinical implication in regard to decreasing risk. So I think the more vigorous training intensity is the way to go when those patients are giving to doing that. Now, so 40 to 60% talk test, it's a good way to start, but it doesn't end there. 2 years ago, 3 years ago, Ray Squires did one of the keynotes at the state meeting. Ash, do you remember when that was, a couple years ago?
2013.
Okay, so Ray Squires is a fairly prolific name. He's a physician. I think he's in the Midwest, Minnesota, maybe something like that. He came down and provided us with a very good lecture on high intensity interval training. And my take home message was, hey, this is the stuff that works the best. Why aren't you doing that? And here's all the data that he presented to show us why. So I'm going to hopefully show you that when you look at high intensity interval training, it is superior to moderate continuous training with regard to outcomes when you consider changes in VO2, cardiorespiratory endurance, the preservation of coronary artery lumen diameter, anti-inflammatory responses, and then left ventricular geometry and performance. So I recall having conversations with patients who've come into my program, and I ask them, so why are you here? And the responses don't stop with, I want to get more fit. Rarely do they say that. The first thing they say is, I want my heart to get stronger and I don't want to have to go through this again. They really don't care about their VO2. We just link their VO2 and their improvements in performance with decreases in risk over time. Well, I want my heart to get stronger. I don't want to have to do this again. Okay? So we have good information that would suggest that HIIT training is a way to go. Now, for those of you who are unfamiliar and you think about the notion of high intensity interval training in a cardiac population, you're thinking that can't be safe. You're going to kill somebody. Well, there's a lot of data out here and a lot of projects that have been done on some very sick people that would suggest it can be done safely. Heart failure. Those are the folks who have those hearts that are weakened and they can't pump effectively to supply the body with what it needs. The heart failure population can do this effectively. They can do it safely as well. The idea that HIIT training is becoming more accepted even has found its way into ACSM's guidelines for exercise testing and prescription, the 10th edition. They make a fairly strong three-sentence statement on the use of high-intensity interval training in cardiac rehab. So as we are challenged to change and get better, these are the kinds of things that, in my opinion, will make you better. So I apologize about the fact that this is pretty hard to see with regard to the size of the font and so forth. I just wanted to touch base with some of you with regard to the training model for interval training. The notion is that individuals, and by the way, if I'm going to train somebody with intervals, I'm going to test them first. I'm going to do a cardiopulmonary exercise test. I'm going to get their VO2s. I'm going to get their heart rates. I'm going to get their AT1s, their AT2s. If you want to know about that, ask Addie. She did research on that in part of her graduate program. So with a high-intensity interval training, as opposed to moderate continuous training, you're taking two groups of individuals. You're going to try to set the volume of exercise to be exactly the same so that one group's not doing more than the other group. The high-intensity interval training group is going to train between 80 and 90%, sometimes higher, just depends on the study, of their VO2 reserve. That's almost at peak for about 3 to 4 minutes. Then they're going to take a break down to 60 to 70% of their VO2 reserve for 3 to 4 minutes. Then they're back up, then they're back down, then they're back up, then they're back down. The idea is to get the recommended number of minutes, somewhere between 40 and 60, and then to do so at a frequency and a duration, 12, 16 weeks, that's, you know, considerate of your outpatient program. Your moderate continuous training program is going to be, and I guess here's your HIIT, here's your moderate continuous, 50 or 40 to 80% of heart rate reserve, 40 to 60 minutes, 3 days a week, blah, blah, blah. You guys are familiar with that. So that once you compare the outcomes with these groups, this is where the fun begins, in my opinion. Here's a study that was done out of Henry Ford. Stephen Katayan's group did this. 15 individuals assigned to high intensity interval training, 14 and 13 individuals to moderate continuous. They did exercise testing pre and post. They found it out, they looked at the results before and after. The changes in peak oxygen uptake for your high intensity interval group were much greater than the changes in oxygen uptake with your moderate continuous training group, and as a result, they concluded in the title, and I think I hopefully have given you the reference on this, that HIIT training is superior to cardio to moderate continuous training in the cardiac rehab patient population. Now, a thing that I wanted to make mention of that Mike had stated earlier, that 3.5 met increase that we talk about making in our patient populations to decrease risk of morbidity and mortality is not a progression of exercise performance. It's a metabolic increase in their maximal aerobic capacity. So by increasing them from 2 mets to 5 mets with their exercise prescription doesn't suggest that you're going to increase their maximal aerobic endurance by 3.5 milliliters per kilogram per minute. You don't know unless you test it. And while I'm mentioning that, one of the shortcomings that we face in cardiac rehab without testing is this idea that we can assign improvements in exercise capacity by simply comparing week 2 and week 12 of their exercise program. because week two can be an arbitrarily low exercise load that doesn't reflect upon what that patient is capable of. So they might not improve at all by week 12. You've just made them do more that was within their capability, possibly at week two. So we have to recognize those limitations. And we have to call that what it is. It is an improvement in what they did, but it's not an improvement in their functional capacity. We don't know what that actual improvement is unless we test it. Here's a study by a group in Europe, Norway. I actually came across this study as I was doing some review of literature for my intensive cardiac rehab program that I've just started at New Hanover. This is very interesting. This is a group of, I think, 18 or so, maybe a little less, individuals who had angiography done. They were catheterized. Then they were assigned to either a high-intensity interval group or they were assigned to usual care. And there was, unfortunately, in the article, no real definition of what the activity was for those individuals who were assigned to usual care. So what they did is they trained them with intervals. I think it was a 12-week durational program. Interval training was 90 to 95% on their work bout. It was 60 to 70% on their rest bout. They went back and did repeat catheterizations, repeat angiography, and they found that the luminal diameters of the coronary arteries had increased more significantly in the training group than in the control group. No surprises there. And unfortunately, this study doesn't allow us to say that this is better than moderate continuous training because it did not compare those two groups. But we know now from this study that with high intensity interval training, the diameters were improved. And this other thing that was really interesting, this late luminal loss in diameter or in area, millimeters of those arteries, that's the stuff that suggests restenosis. The amount of restenosis was fairly small when you compare control to training. So when you work with your patients, one of the biggest frustrations we always have had is what? The repeat offenders. Hannah and I were talking about this last night. The individuals who, while they do what they're supposed to do, they still come back and they have problems. Well, there's a lot of issue that goes on with that, and it's not just what the patient does. Whenever you stick a wire in an artery, whenever you suture a vessel to another vessel, you are injuring that myocardium. You are setting into motion the entire response to injury process that promotes atherogenesis. That's why these drugs that are being prescribed are so important in trying to keep those vessels open. Then if you add this injured myocardium, you add to that some poor behaviors like blood pressure issues or cholesterol or stress, which elicits the entire sympathetic, parasympathetic imbalance, you're only going to accelerate the idea that these vessels are going to close down again. Side note and advertisement, I have come to the realization that the only way that we're going to effectively give our patients the best possible of all outcomes is through the intensive cardiac rehab lifestyle. These people need to be eating twigs and berries. They need to control their stress. They need to emotionalize their feelings and their support. I know that's hard for you guys to believe, but I believe this to be true. And they need to exercise. But their therapy cannot be focused only on exercise. What they eat is terribly important, but how they control their stress and how they verbalize their feelings is just as important. All right, so we've got vessels that are open and we've got more important, or we got improvements in cardiorespiratory endurance. What about the rats? The rats tell us that if we were to take two groups of rats, do a sham surgery and do an infarct surgery, coronary artery ligation sham surgery, and then we were to compare outcomes in those two groups of rats, and we can train the MI rats and we can leave a half of those MI rats untrained or sedentary, and then we can compare them to the controls. Now we begin to see some of the cool measurements that we can make with left ventricular geometry and performance. So all of these other things, we'll just set this aside, but we have two groups, sham, MI. What you need to see there is that myocardial contractility as measured by fractional shortening is significantly and clinically depressed in your MI-operated rats. This just shows us that the surgery that they did was effective. They induced a heart attack, which affected myocardial performance. Then we can look at the geometry of the left ventricle. We can talk about diastolic diameters. We can talk about systolic diameters. We can talk about anterior wall thicknesses and posterior wall thicknesses. So in normal rats, your left ventricular diameters at systole and diastole are going to be much thinner or smaller. We volume overload hearts that are failing. So we hold more fluid, which creates a bigger chamber, okay? A just bigger ventricular dimension. When we hold that fluid and we stretch that chamber, the natural response is for the walls to become thinner. When the walls become thinner, sarcomeres, myosin, actin, all those wonderful things that cause contractility, they start to malalign. When we malalign or misalign our actin myosin, what happens to contraction? It becomes lessened, it becomes less forceful. So now we have performance issues. So we got what we wanted to with regard to, or they got what they wanted to with regard to proving that the MI causes all these wonderful problems. The walls thin, the chambers get bigger, and the heart doesn't contract as effectively. If we then take those MI rats and put them on a high intensity interval training program, and yes, they make rat treadmills, and you can interval train rats very effectively, we find that these issues defined up here start to go away. So you'll notice our MI sedentary rat is the sickest of our sick, right? That's the rat that's had a heart attack and is sitting on the couch doing nothing. And these are the problems that they're going to run into. So these chambers get even bigger, the walls get even thinner, problems get even worse. Contractility is even less. But if we start to train these individuals, and if we take these individuals through an interval training program, what happens? The chambers get smaller. They don't normalize. They're not back to what they used to be, but they're better than they were. The chambers get smaller. The geometry, the morphology of the muscular walls actually begins to move back toward what it was before the infarct. So the walls start thickening up. You can imagine what happens if they thicken up. Actin myosin come into a better positional representation of each other, and as a result of that, more forceful contraction will occur. Positive changes in the rat heart. So the next question is, okay, rats are good, but what happens in people? So here's the next study that I wanted to take a look at. And here we have a study in people that's beginning to look at a lot of the same thing. Superior cardiovascular effect of aerobic interval training, okay? There is a reason when you read an article, the title of the slide is, or the title of the paper is very important. They meant to say that because of what they found with this particular study. So here you have, I think we had 20 and 20 individuals who were catheterized, defined to moderate continuous training or interval training, tested at baseline, tested at follow-up. Look at these VO2 levels at baseline, 13, 13, and 13. How many mets? Three mets? A little more than three mets? These are not well people. These are people with sick hearts, okay? These are heart failure patients that are going through this protocol. Their anaerobic thresholds were all fairly confined, a little bit above. I told you earlier that heart failure patients generally tend to have a ventilatory anaerobic threshold that's a little bit higher because of other peripheral changes that go on the muscle, and these guys actually did. Their percent of peak AT, their ventilatory anaerobic threshold at peak of oxygen uptake, didn't change much, but the amount of oxygen that they were actually consuming at those time points did significantly change, which suggests that they were able to do more work before the onset of anaerobic metabolism began to occur. So I thought those two aspects to be interesting to kind of go back to our changes in cardiorespiratory conditioning. Then, when you begin to look at stuff that we're interested in or talking about, here's your left ventricular diastolic dimension, left ventricular systolic dimension, left ventricular end diastolic volumes, All of those things we talked about in the previous slide, those changes were found in humans as well as rats. The heart is getting stronger. The heart is becoming less dimensionally overloaded. And we're also finding out what? Stroke volume's going up, cardiac output's going up, and EF is going up in our high intensity interval training group. So in humans, we see very positive changes in that heart musculature and performance as a result of high intensity interval training, especially when you compare it to the moderate continuous training model. So here's ACSM's statement. I don't want to read this to you, but this is actually in the guidelines now. High intensity interval training for cardiac rehab populations is being endorsed by ACSM. I think that's the kind of progress that we all need to pay attention to as exercise physiologists. So we have a training method that is superior than another, but it might not be for everybody. I agree with that. Many of your patients are not going to be candidates for high intensity interval training. But here's my challenge to all of the programs. Do you have the capacity to flex up when you need to, so that when that 45-year-old or that 50-year-old comes to you and says, hey, I want to run a 10K, I've got a lot of life to live, I want to do all these things, can you provide him the type of exercise prescription as if he were an athlete that is safe and effective? And that's the real challenge with exercise physiology and cardiac rehab. It's not whether you can just, you know, put in your 20 minutes, and it's not whether you can get them through 12 weeks. And it's good for them to feel appreciated, and it's good for them to have a positive feeling. But in my opinion, that exercise prescription is a tool. It's a very important tool that we use to improve cardiorespiratory endurance, cardiac performance and efficiencies, and decrease risk over time. Prognostic values as well, morbidities and mortalities. So, changing gears, what about resting heart rate plus 20? One of the first things I did when I started at Appalachian State and became the clinical director of their cardiac rehab program as well is wanted to take a little closer look at whether or not this method of assigning exercise intensity is really effective, and is it uniform? I had my questions. Admittedly, you guys can understand what my bias are, but I'm going to tell you kind of why my bias is the way it is. First of all, when I was starting out in cardiac rehab in the early 90s, I would do some phase one training with patients, and this was the exercise prescription that we would use when we were walking patients through the halls a day after they had a bypass, or 2 days after they had a bypass, or the next day after they had an angioplasty. So something didn't connect in my mind about whether or not this is the same prescription I should use for somebody who's convalesced for 8 weeks and should be feeling better, and if I asked them to do the same thing they were doing 2 days out of surgery in the hospital, it just didn't seem like it should be quite so easy. There's got to be a better way. But the reason it was the way it was because we didn't have anything else. This was the only thing we had to default to. There was a study, it was a project that we did in my program. We took a look at resting heart rate plus 20. We took a group of people. We took 18 of our cardiac rehab patients who had elected to do a cardiopulmonary exercise test and agreed to being retested at week 1, 6, and 12. And what we did was we determined in that group of individuals what their VO2 values were when they were walking at steady state on a treadmill and were measuring their oxygen consumption in the lab. And we found the interesting thing here is, and you can just for right now ignore the low and the high, but in individuals who had a lower oxygen uptake baseline, they were working at about 62% of their VO2 reserve when we prescribed exercise at resting heart rate plus 20. So they're working at 20.5 beats above their resting heart rate, and their VO2 reserve is at 62%. Those who are more fit, they're training the same amount, 22.8, a little bit higher, but 2 beats, not that much. And their VO2 reserve is 42%. So we all know one of the general principles of exercise prescription is the idea that your more fit individuals require more exercise intensity to provide for improvements. So if we take these more fit people and we start them out at this lower level, what's not going to happen? And if we don't build progressions in there, what's not going to happen over 12 weeks? And here's the bigger concern to me. If you take an individual who is more fit and accustomed to doing more work before they come into your cardiac rehab program, and you exercise them at a level that's less than what they're used to at home, what are they not going to do? They're not coming back, and you're going to lose them. But they need to be reconditioned because they have all those risk issues that they need to deal with as well. So the point here is this. Not all people are served the same way by prescribing exercise at resting heart rate plus 20. It is not uniform in your population of individuals. So we have to recognize it has some limits. I also wanted to point out here that it's unlikely over time, that is 12 weeks, for us to see any corresponding changes in heart rates or stroke volumes that would suggest that if they exercise at that same 20 beats above, that they're doing more work. So I don't believe that there's progression built into this resting heart rate plus 20 model. If you're not advancing their prescription by virtue of resting heart rate plus 30, resting heart rate plus 40, you're probably not asking them to do more work. Okay? So here we see that over time, resting heart rates, this is 12 weeks, didn't change. There was no change in resting heart rate in these individuals. Now, they might have been doing a little more work. It might have taken a little more speed or a little more grade to get their heart rate 20 beats above. But their VO2, you remember those VO2s before were in the 13 range or 12 range? Didn't change at all. So the amount of work that you're asking somebody to do is actually best measured by the amount of oxygen they're consuming. Their heart rate is secondary. We don't care. We care about their heart rate, but it is a surrogate measure for oxygen uptake. So they weren't increasing the amount of their work that they were doing over time. Okay? It was always static. There was no progression in there if we kept them at 20 beats. Now, another study showing some interesting things came out of Wake Forest in 2004. About the time that we were looking at this project, this one was a couple of years old, but this is interesting. So Pete Brubaker and a couple of his colleagues took, I think it was 13 cardiac rehab patients, did cardiopulmonary exercise testing before their program, after their program. And in between there, they took those individuals, or at the beginning of their program, this is a one-time thing, they put on the ambulatory oxygen uptake system, the K4B2 from COSMED. They had them walk over ground, I'm assuming it was a track or something like that. They measured their oxygen uptake at 20 beats above rest. They had them do another test, and they measured their, or they asked them to perform at an RPE of 11 to 13. So if we don't have heart rate or exercise test data, our two defaults are what? Heart rate plus 20, RPEs, right? That's how we prescribe. This is what's interesting. For this group of individuals, who, when we look at the lighter colored bars, for this group of individuals who were walking at a resting heart rate plus 20 in this case, a large percentage of those individuals were training below 40% of their VO2 reserve, and even larger were between 40 and 60, and then only a couple were above 60%. So we tended to err on the conservative side for this mixed heterogeneous population of individuals when regard to prescribing their exercise. The interesting thing is when you ask them to perform at an RP of 11 to 13, what did they do? They did just the opposite. Most of the individuals, the dark bars now, were training well above their VO2 reserve levels, somewhere in the 70 to 80, and one of them was even greater than 85%. My point is this. Don't assume that the tools we're used to using, in this case, resting heart rate plus 20, and even RPE, mean the same thing to everybody, okay? And they don't. They're different, and there's some evidence to suggest that to be the case. So, I've mentioned this before. I'm leading you down a road because I want to give you something to take home. Even in individuals who are beta blocked, when we do maximal graded exercise testing and we measure oxygen consumption, and the reason we want to do testing with oxygen uptake is because we can define physiology with that VO2 data, with that VCO2 data. We can also assure appropriate efforts are being provided by the patients, okay? If you get treadmill data back from the doctor's office, they did a stress test before they started the program. First of all, do you know that they gave a maximal effort during the test? Was that heart rate that's coming off of that paper truly representative of what that individual is capable of? How do you know? Secondly, if they give you a MET value from a treadmill like a Bruce protocol, were they holding the handrails? Because if they were, about 20% of their oxygen uptake is reduced. They're more efficient when the handrail holds, so we have to take that into account. So in my opinion, data from a general stress test is of value when you look at ST segment changes in myocardial ischemia, but a very little help when it comes to exercise prescription. It's helpful, it's better than nothing, but it's not the best that it could be. The addition of oxygen uptake values, gas exchange measurements makes all of the difference in the world. Now, if we know that exercising at higher intensities might be more beneficial to our patients, and that prescribing exercise at 20 to 30 might not be the best method, and that some of our younger patients might have a desire to return toward a more vigorous lifestyle, and I threw this one in because I found this to be really interesting. I was in a meeting with a bunch of cardiologists with our cardiology group at New Hanover, introducing my intensive cardiac rehab program. And we were beginning to talk about how to get the patients referred. And I overheard a couple of guys talking to each other and say, yeah, he's too young. I'm not gonna refer him to cardiac rehab because he'd be bored. So what that meant to me was the program at New Hanover had earned the reputation or the perception from the physicians that they're not going to provide an appropriate exercise prescription for the younger, more fit individual. I think that's really a problem. I don't ever want that to ever be said about any program that I'm involved in, okay? We have to meet the patients where they are. So sometimes we've got to get way above resting heart rate plus 20 to 30. We've got to be smart about monitoring hemodynamics and looking at EKG changes, rates and rhythms, and we got to let them work. They got to sweat. They got to feel like they can be safe reestablishing a lifestyle that they want to have. So we need to be able to confidently prescribe exercise at high intensities. The best way to do this is through testing. Now, I know there are big walls that are set up in front of all of us to be able to do that, but I've spent several years knocking walls down, and really what it comes down to, in my opinion, is a passionate desire to see the change take place, because the data's there. You don't have to make up the arguments. You just have to organize one based on the research, based on what you're being told to do. Our profession calls us to do exercise testing, okay? The American Heart Association, in their scientific statement, Clinician's Guide to Cardiopulmonary Exercise Testing, states that exercise testing remains a remarkably durable and versatile tool, okay? They even say that the addition of ventilatory gas exchange measurements during exercise testing provides a wide array of unique measurements. This wasn't my opinion. This is what I was told by the American Heart Association. The American College of Sports Medicine says what? Exercise testing at baseline is essential for the development of an exercise prescription in patients who have suffered from MI with or without revascularization. Okay? Once again, not my opinion, ACSM's. The European Association of Cardiovascular Prevention says what? Cardiopulmonary exercise testing is a methodology that has profoundly changed the approach to patients' functional evaluation. Okay? You can read the rest of it. There's a lot of good data that comes from an exercise test. One more. This is going to open up a can of worms, but we're going to do it anyway. AACVPR says to establish a safe and effective comprehensive cardiovascular risk reduction, blah, blah, blah. A medical evaluation and exercise test before participating is important. Okay? They then go on to say, this is the disappointing part, they then go on to say that the 6-minute walk test can be used as a surrogate test to assess exercise capacity. That's not true. I do not believe that to be the case, and I'm going to show you why. It's true sometimes. Perhaps I was a little too strong. It's true sometimes. So what about the 6-minute walk test do we need to embrace? Well, first of all, if you're working with a homogeneous group of individuals who are severely debilitated from a physical or functional capacity, your debilitated CHF patients, your cardiomyopathy patients, your aortic stenotic patients, you guys can come up with the idea, your COPD patients. This is a very good test to measure two things, to correlate it with their peak VO2, and to mark therapeutic efficacy by doing serial tests over time. So in this group of patients who had cardiomyopathy, these authors found that peak VO2 and 6-minute walk test distance were highly correlated with an R value of 0.71. And you guys, your correlation coefficients, if you're above 6, above 7, it's a strong correlation. If you're in the 5 to 7 range, you're probably in a moderate correlation. And if you're below 5, throw it away. It's no good, okay? Your R squared, I'm going to get into in a little while. We'll tell you what that means. But in a group or subset of people who are significantly debilitated, 6-minute walk test is the way to go. For pulmonary patients, I think this is a good test. But what is the profile of our cardiac patient? It's all ends of the spectrum, right? It's a mixed bag. It's a heterogeneous group of people. I had my 43-year-old tested 2 weeks ago. His peak VO2 was 32, okay? I had another fellow, he was 67, he was 18. I've tested other folks along the way who have been in the 13s, 14s, and 15s. You're gonna get a wide range of functional capacities in cardiac rehab. And when you do, our 6-minute walk test loses its correlation efficacy. So if we were to take a look at 6-minute walk distance and peak VO2 correlations, and consider a heterogeneous group of people, okay, this is coming from Ross's paper, our correlation coefficient goes down to about below 6 from a 0.71. Still a positive relationship, right? Still, if one goes up, the other goes up, that's okay. But how much does a 6-minute walk test distance predict oxygen uptake? Because remember, those wonderful benefits in risk reduction, mortality, and morbidity, they don't come from 6-minute walk distance time. They only come when that VO2 goes up by 3.5. So does a change in 6-minute walk test distance reflect a change in peak VO2? I'm going to show you something in just a minute that might help you understand that a little better. Even in this study that showed that correlation coefficient of a 0.58, here are the peak VO2s. This was a meta-analysis study. This is kind of clever, but it's limited. So all of these studies were put together. These authors had a computer software program that actually allowed them to take pictures of the data points and recreate those data points in a massive regenerated scatter plot that then allowed them to develop their own correlation coefficient. They borrowed the data, took a picture of it, migrated through a computer software program. This is where they ended up. But even still, all of the data that they took, look at the peak VO2s, 12, 9, 14, 13. This is a fairly low functioning group of individuals. This is not your 20s. I showed you a slide earlier. The average entry level peak VO2 in my cardiac rehab population is about 23 to 25 milliliters per kilogram per minute. So we began to ask the question, if I'm doing a 6-minute walk test, and it's easier to do, it's less expensive, it's something that I can do on everybody, without any question, don't have to get a referral, don't have to have a lab, don't have to have equipment, don't have to have training, then if it's meaningful, I'll use it. If it's not meaningful, I'm not doing it. Bad data is worse than no data, in my opinion, okay? So here's my correlation coefficient, 0.582, sounds familiar, just like the other, on a subset of 18 patients who had performed both a cardiopulmonary exercise test and a 6-minute walk test. Not great, okay? Not a great correlation, but I'm not dissuaded from the 6-minute walk test yet. Until I ask the question, but what happens if I want to suggest that a change in a 6-minute walk test distance is also going to suggest a change in peak VO2? So when we look at pre and post cardiopulmonary exercise testing, and we compared change in peak VO2, change in 6-minute walk distance, My correlation coefficient went down to 0.139. Okay? Throw it out the door. What that tells you, if you square the value, you get an R squared value, you got a 0.01. It says, to what degree can you attribute changes in peak VO2 to changes in 6-minute walk test distance? And the answer in this group of people was nothing, okay? So here's what I believe. In the right subset of patients, when we are testing using the 6-minute walk test distance, we have an effective tool. When we are widening our net and getting a heterogeneous group of people and using this test, we have to recognize that it's good for one thing. Showing the patient how many meters they improved. Can you use that data to suggest that their VO2 went up? No. Can you use that data to suggest that their risk for CAD has gone down? No. It is simply, did they perform better? And that might be a confidence builder in some, and I certainly get that it would be, but we have to limit our we have to maintain our understanding with that particular issue. So, what are we going to do about all this? We have holes in process, in my opinion. We have things we've been doing for way too long that are limited in their value with regard to what they afford us from our rehab programs, but they still can be valuable, but only when they're understood in context. So in the right people, these are good tests. In my opinion, a VO2 less than 15 mils, that 5 met that high risk group cutoff, that 5 met level, that's probably who this test is good for. It's been shown to be good in heart failure, pulmonary, COPD, aortic stenosis, cardiomyopathy. But if you're testing a wide array or training a wide array of individuals, you can't use it. Now here's the other issue that I have, and I've seen this happen in my own backyard. Your 6-minute walk tests need to be performed exactly the same way as everybody else's 6-minute walk test. You can't use a track to do a 6-minute walk test because that invalidates the number. We know significant distance improvements come when you're walking around a track. You have to do a cone walk test. The distance of that track or that length of that cone walk needs to be between 20 and 34 meters. You need to provide the standardized encouragement for all people. You can't change a word to anybody. And you cannot walk with your patients because you're falsely changing their rate of progression. They have to do it on their own. If you guys are feeding data into the AACDPR registry and you're throwing in track walk data, you just killed it because you're throwing in data that is not representative of what this true test was designed to do. Now, the other thing you're doing by not standardizing is you're not allowing a patient who's being followed serially, who may go from 1 5-minute cards, okay, who might be going from one area to another, you're not allowing for comparative results to be accurate, okay? Your 300 meters isn't the same as my cone walk 300 meters. They're two different results. I encourage you to look into the ATS guidelines if you haven't already, and you must follow those guidelines if you're going to use that test. Okay, 5 minutes. Sorry, Hannah. Fight for cardiopulmonary exercise test. If you're an exercise physiologist and you're passionate about this, go break down some walls. Use the tools that you have to convince the people that you work with that this is a necessary process. I just put in a proposal to my group that in 2.7 years, I'm going to have paid for my $60,000 system, and I'm going to be making $25,000 a year by getting the referrals on my patients that I believe I can get, okay? And I can do it without a guilty conscience because the Heart Association, the ACSM, the AACVPR, and the European Cardiovascular Prevention Society tell me that I should be doing it anyway, so we should be doing this. If you're not going to be able to get to that point, consider resting heart rate progressions that go beyond 20 to 30. Why not 20 to 30, 30 to 40, 40 to 50? If their blood pressure is normal, their RPEs are good, their ST segments look fine, or their rhythm looks good, why not? Give them the room, give them the chance. And even consider using that carbonin or heart rate reserve method in your exercise prescriptive process, even if they take beta blockers. There are going to be outliers. You'll find those people out pretty quickly, but some people you'll find will fall right in line with that particular method. Always treat the monitor, not the patient. A heart rate that's too high in an individual who feels good, looks good, and wants to do more, I think it's okay. Don't say, it's above 130, we gotta stop. If everything else is stable, keep it going. And then if you can find a way to integrate HIIT training, I think you're doing a better job. Not for everybody, but for some. I think I might have made you 5 minutes. Questions? Sir.
I'm just wondering if you run into issues with insurance reimbursement, like if patients have stress tests with their physician, and then you do a test with them.
You need to be aware. They're not going to pay for two tests within probably a 6-month window, right? So you need to be aware. The other point of it is when you code the stress test, you're evaluating dyspnea on exertion, which everybody gets short of breath with exercise, right? To evaluate that data. But yeah, you need to be mindful.
And you're doing VO2 testing with your patients?
Oh yeah, I've had two cohorts of high intense or of intensive cardiac patients, 13 and 8. I've done 10 tests so far and probably will do more. The docs love it when they know you know what you're doing and you're using the data. I have not had any physician put up any kind of a fight with regard to getting a referral for this. And it is the best thing I can do for these patients. And I, you know, with a clear conscience can pursue that. And the patients want to know. They want to know, what can I do safely? Here's the thing, and I give you, and sorry, Hannah. I had two guys, both of them want to get back to work. They're in their mid-40s. Take them in the lab, I do this test on them. They've been walking on eggshells for 8 weeks after their event. They've got a lot of life to live. They've got a job to get back to. They want to reestablish that normal. I took them in the lab. We did their test. Everything was final. They ripped off that mask. They were breathing heavy. They got this big smile on their face. They put their head down, and they just were relieved. They knew that they weren't going to explode. Their heart was fine. Everything was good. And it was almost like you gave them their normal card back, that they could go back and live their lives the way that they wanted to. That's the kind of thing that I really am excited about with this testing. It reestablishes normal life in the right populations. Dave?
I agree with everything you said, 200%, except a couple of things. And I'll give you my experience. New Carolina Cardiology, I've tested 40,000 patients in my career. And we've had, I agree, great to do cardiopulmonary stress testing, but I don't think it's going to happen there just because of the time factor. The doctors have to see the patients after the test. It takes a lot more time. So you're under the restraints of whatever
you are.
You're working for, but it gives you a lot more information. But I think the regular stress test doesn't give you as much information, but it still gives you plenty of information to exercise prescription. When I was up there, we did that. This is years ago. We did 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, 2 years. I fought for that. We were all in agreement. But you know, the trend now is to go away from stress testing. Churches won't pay for it because they say it's unnecessary, which I disagree with, but I agree with you. So I think that the regular stress test has a lot of value, especially with ECG tracing analysis. You know?
And I agree with that. And I believe that it's certainly a whole lot better than nothing. But I still, when I was doing just the stress test, do you know that that's the peak capability of that individual? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. For me, I'm always the guy that's gonna wanna have the numbers to justify it. And as far as other issues go with regard to setting up process and so on and so forth to be able to have the time, I'm a big believer that you can find a way. And as long as you don't have to ask more of your doctors, if you can go in and do that testing yourself and just simply say, I need you to interpret this for me, it's usually not a problem. Or it hasn't been in my experience anyway.
Yeah, it's definitely ideal. The last point is a six-minute walk test. I just talked to folks in the mountain region about the mistakes made during the six-minute walk test. Like you said, it's going to be the same. But in my opinion, it's Two new papers up from the European Respiratory Society, I believe, just came out a year ago, or maybe this year. They kind of open up the door. Yeah, you can do around the track. And when I say that, you do, because we did all of ours around the track over at the, down the street there. Their study showed that they're getting a higher walking value, right? They can walk better around the track, so they're functioning. You're getting a truer picture, not of their peak functional capacity, but of their walking capacity. So if you do it initially like that, then you do it in the follow-up, you're comparing apples to apples.
Right. And I agree with that, and that you can compare those distances to each other to show and document improvements in 6-minute walk distance, but you can't do anything more with it with regard to serially analyzing efficacy of treatments that are based on that 300 meter threshold that is used by many groups and many populations. And as long as you reestablish normal guidelines with track walking as opposed to the out and back, it can become a great test, but there's going to be a lot of work that needs to be done before that happens.
Well, you'll need, like I said, you'll need standardization of people just doing track walking. The reason they put that in the guidelines, and those out there early, those are 2002 guidelines.
That's the most recent one. This was 2013 that I brought that from.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, my bad. The reason they say, you know, it's going to be a walking fringe of cone, because not everybody has a track, you know, just very few people. They can't put a track in there because a lot of doctors do it in their office. But I don't think a test walking in a hallway in an office, especially with people with the rollators and buggies around cones, is giving you a true indication of their function.
Well, I mean, that was a big part of my point too. I think the test, when we understand the context with which it can be performed, can be valuable. But we know that you can't use 6-minute walk distance to predict peak VO2.
Right.
It doesn't work for the individual. It works in groups of people, but not the individuals. Another limitation, so if you're using how many meters they covered in 6 minutes to determine what their peak VO2 is, it doesn't work. You can't do it.
I agree.
Yeah. Sorry, Hannah.
You're okay.